Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Let me just get a little organized. And just to confirm, when the light is off, our mic is on, right? Okay, thank you. All right, today is June 21st, 2023. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning and our entire calendar. And the first one is A23-0287. Charlene, Karen, can someone help me pronounce it?
Junt,
thank you, versus Marcus Edward Junt. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. You may both know, but the podium toggles up and down. There's a toggle switch, so if you need it up a little bit, you can just put it up. When you take the podium, just please state your name and a party you represent for the record. And counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Philip Gainsley for appellant Marcus Junt.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to move it up a little bit? Are you comfortable with where it is, the podium for you?
I think so. Thank
you. Okay, go ahead then.
With the time running out at the last minute, Ms. Junt commenced an action against Mr. Junt to renew a judgment that she had 10 years ago. I represent Marcus Junt, the defendant, judgment debtor in that matter. And what she did was she first filed the summons and complaint with the district court administrator. Then she sent a process server to California, where the parties hadn't resided for 30 years, where Mr. Junt hadn't been in three decades, to serve him there. That failed. So then she tried to serve him at his office, Suites, a virtual office in Chandler, Arizona. And she couldn't serve him there. The receptionist said to the process server, he's never here. This is a virtual office. So she failed to serve him in California, failed to serve
him. Hadn't he identified that as a place where he received mail?
Yes. That's not service of process.
No,
as a matter of fact, the law is very...
I understand that. We're familiar with the background facts here. So if you'd focus on there was service at the Pacifico's house. So why was that not adequate? That was in the judge's findings.
That's what the judge said there was service. The judge is wrong.
Why is that wrong when your client said under oath that he lives there?
No, he didn't.
And that's a proper place for service?
No, Your Honor.
So explain to me why that the judge was wrong. That's what I think you should focus
on. That was a Pacifico house. It wasn't the Pacifico house where he resided. And Ms. Junt made some misjudgments on that. She erred.
Is there anything in the record on where he actually, which Pacifico house he actually resided
in? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Her own investigation.
Let me finish. Where would I find that?
In counsel's affidavit, where his investigator says there are two addresses for Mr. Junt, the street address, Beardsley, where he lived, and his mailing address that you pointed out, the office suites. He never resided. He was never at the Pacifico house that she thought he was at. When he said under oath that he was at the Pacifico house, she added two and two and got five. She had some mailings that had a Pacifico address. That wasn't the address.
So I understand your argument is that the Beardsley address, I forget what was the other address that was?
Longhorn.
Longhorn, that's right. So I think at the deposition he says, I live with my friends at Pacifico's. And then
it wasn't a deposition, but yes.
Sorry, you're right.
Hearing.
He's put under oath at the hearing, sorry. And then service was attempted. You say it was not completed at the Longhorn address.
Right.
And you're saying, oh, yes, but the Beardsley address that's on his driver's license was also a Pacifico house. And that's what he meant. And the hearing didn't give the address, right? It didn't say the street name. It said Pacifico house. And you're saying the Beardsley one is also a Pacifico house. That's what I meant. What tells us, where in the record do we find that the Beardsley address is a home owned by Pacifico?
It's what he said.
Where?
He said he testified.
The Beardsley, that connects the Beardsley address to Pacifico, besides what you're saying he meant in his mind when he said, I'm living at the Pacifico
address.
Well,
the best evidence of that is what Ms. Junt's investigator said. She hired this investigator 8 days before the judgment was going to expire, and the investigator concluded that he lived in the Beardsley house and that his office, where he picked up his mail, was the Chandler house.
Right, but what connected Beardsley address? Where in a record do I look to say Pacifico-owned Beardsley address? That's what I'm asking about. Because the other side says that's not in a record anywhere. Where can you, I think that's what they said in their briefs, where can you show me that the Pacifico owned the Beardsley address? And that's what I'm wondering what we should look at to find that. You know what I'm saying?
No, it's a given when he says he's when the investigator and the driver's license all say that he's in the Beardsley house. Why would that be questioned?
Why would it be questioned whether Pacifico owns that house?
No, that he lives, regardless of whether Pacifico owns it, his address was at the Beardsley address. The fact that it was owned by Pacifico is really irrelevant.
Well, it's not irrelevant when he said at a hearing, I'm living at the Pacifico house. That's how Pacifico comes into it at all, right? Because he says that's where he's living.
Probably, but let me say this about that hearing. I think that hearing is irrelevant. It is not up to him to tell anyone where he lives. He had
actually, there was a court order requiring him to update his address. So actually, he was required to say where he lived.
I'm sorry, you're referring to Appendix A, and that is not applicable here. I disagree, Your Honor, respectfully, and let me tell you why. Appendix A, by statute, refers to child support, maintenance, and parenting issues. Those are the reasons for Appendix A. Those are the reasons that a party must give.
So you're saying that this judgment was for child support arrearages, though,
no,
correct?
No, it was not.
If it was for child support
arrearages, it would be an administrative hearing. She wouldn't have had to sue. I think if I hadn't made it clear, I need to make it clear.
But what was this judgment for?
It's unknown. It wasn't maintenance. It wasn't child support. If it was child support, it would proceed by administrative review. We wouldn't be here today if this was child support. Child support is one of those exceptions to renew a judgment can be done administratively and not through court. And that leads me to the greater issue is this is litigation. The legislature said there's a summons and complaint. This is not administrative. It's got to be done. It's got to be done correctly. If it were maintenance, that's a different issue. Child support, that's a different issue. Farm foreclosure judgments, I mean, there's some that do not require litigation. She has a duty. She's plaintiff. This is not, you know, counsel says in the memorandum, this should have been a simple renewal of judgment. It's litigation. Simple or not, it's litigation. And she made it more complex by not knowing where he lived. And she had, in theory, 10 years to determine where he lived. These parties, if you read the record here, were together in court from time and time and time again. He wasn't hiding. He could have been served at any one of those hearings. But the fact is, in September, when this judgment was about to expire, then she decides to hire an investigator. And that investigator obviously told her where to live, but by that time it was too late. Well, if she could hire an investigator in September, she could have hired that investigator in July. You know, she's a plaintiff. She's got some obligations here, too. If this were something that were an automatic judgment, that would be different. But as the legislature and these courts have said, you've got to start a new action, and that's litigation. We have two adverse parties to each other. And as a plaintiff, she has an obligation to know where he lives. But I want to double down on that, Your Honor. The Appendix A does not require him to disclose. It might have at one time when there was child support owing. It might have at one time when there was maintenance owing. It might have one time when there were parenting issues, but no longer.
So I think, counsel, that thank you for that. I think that the question for us clearly is, was there clear error in concluding that your client lived at the Longhorn address,
Absolutely.
And I think that the argument in favor of you know, that there wasn't clear air is that he said under oath that he lived at a Pacifico's house. He was living at Pacifico's house. You know, there was information at Pacifico owned that Longhorn house, and that mailings had been made with a return address from ex-husband to her from that address, Longhorn address. Why isn't that enough to sustain, even if there, you know, even if there's evidence contrary-wise, which I think might have been developed later, but why isn't that enough to sustain under the clear error standard of review? Well, if there's information to sustain it, we don't consider and reweigh everything.
There's two reasons, Your Honor. One is, you're assuming that when he gave that testimony under oath before the magistrate, that he knew that she had before her some evidence of what a Pacifico address was, these envelopes or checks. There's no evidence that he knew that she would rely on that. He simply said, I live with his friend Pacifico. She then added up two and two and came up with five. She saw these envelopes or whatever, quote, surrounding circumstances is what she says in her memorandum in her brief, and said, oh, that must be where it is. But she was wrong in making that assumption. And she had a larger duty than to simply rely upon that. But there's a second reason where there's clear error. One of the reasons, as a matter of fact, one of the significant, if not the significant reason, the court found that he was served was when the Minneapolis process server made a note as to what the Arizona process server said that the, quote, owner of the house said. That's hearsay on hearsay on hearsay. And it is true that a court can exercise its discretion in allowing hearsay. Not here. This was dispositive. This hearsay is, she said, I am especially troubled by, we don't know who said what to whom. We certainly don't know that when the Arizona process service said he spoke with the owner, that was the owner. There was no foundation for that. And the trial court judge relied upon the hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay.
I don't think it's actually hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay. Like the statement by, it may not matter in the end, but the statement that's alleged, the out-of-court statement by the person who answered the door, I don't know the person, et cetera, is not offered for the truth of matter asserted. I don't think that even is hearsay. I assume that they're not offering it to prove that he, in fact, doesn't know him. But then you have the second thing, which is the person who wrote the affidavit said, so-and-so said this happened. I do agree that that's probably hearsay. Whether that should come in under an exception, et cetera, I think that you objected and it was not addressed by the trial court.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, normally speaking, and generally speaking, we leave that to the discretion of the trial court. Well, it's hearsay, but I'll, you know, take it for what. Not here. We have too much at stake here. She was wrong. She was clearly wrong. And it's a good example of a poor practice of simply adopting grammatical errors and all what a party says and making those your findings of fact. And unfortunately, that's what this judge did. You compare the argument and the findings of fact, they're almost verbatim. And that's wrong. You know, the Bliss case tells us a judge should go beyond, you can adopt someone's findings, but you gotta explain why and how. So the hearsay is a significant issue here.
But counsel, we do leave those kind of evidence.
I'm sorry?
We do leave those evidentiary issues to the discretion of the trial.
But then there's the abuse of that discretion, and that's what happened here. I'm sorry?
With all the exceptions to hearsay?
Yes, so it doesn't. Judge, I have it right here.
It does. Catch-all at the end that says if it's otherwise reliable, it's up to the trial.
Well, sure, it's up to the trial judge, but the trial judge can err, and she did here. She simply did. We don't know who the owner was. We don't know that was the owner. Maybe it was the gardener. We don't know. Maybe it was a friend of the owner. But I think it's very important when whatever this person says, I don't know the Junts, and she relies upon that, we got to go beyond that. Maybe what the answer is, that we've asked the court to remand with instructions to dismiss, it may be that the court should simply remand. We'll take testimony as to who said what to whom. That's going to be the, under oath, under pursuant to examination and cross-examination. I cannot stress enough that regardless of what he said, and everything he said was true in that hearing, he said he lived at Dennis Pacifico's house, and he said that when asked, is that the address on your license, driver's license? He said, yes, yes. And both of those answers were true. And we know they're true because the investigator hired 8 days before the expiration by Ms. Junt said it was true. He came back and said to Ms. Junt, his address is Beardsley, and then for mailing, Chandler, Arizona. It can't be better than that.
On your rebuttal, could you address what the law is around somebody who's actively evading service?
I'm sorry.
The process server went to the Beardsley house several times. And so what, if you would address law around evading service at the Beardsley house, and then what difference does it make the hearsay you point out about the Hunts were unknown at the Pacifico house? What difference does that make to the district court's findings? And if you would do that on rebuttal, I'm assuming.
Okay. Unless you would like an answer, I'm totally up to you.
No, it's up to
okay.
you, Judge Smith.
Great. If you can address those things on rebuttal, you'll have 5 minutes
sure.
for rebuttal if you need more time.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your argument, counsel, for respondent. And then we'll just remember, when the light is off, the mic is active up here on the bench. It's different from some others, but we're ready for you. 15 minutes.
Good morning, and thank you, Your Honors. My name is Ben Court. I am here today on behalf of the respondent, Charlene Junt, who is in the courtroom. Also in the courtroom with me is my associate, Casey Phillips, a former clerk of this fine court, and a summer associate that came with us today, Mr. David Lamb. To set the stage for what I just want to have the panel keep in mind, although this is a de novo review, as we all know, the evidence here must be viewed in a light most favorable to the district court's findings, and those findings must stand unless they're clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion. And the Shamrock case is just one of many examples of how this court and other courts have determined that. To first address a point that was brought up by this court, and I just want to make sure that it's perfectly clear to all of you, that you will not find a connection anywhere in the record between Dennis Pacifico and the Beardsley address because no such connection exists. Two, with regard to the driver's license issue.
Why do you?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
You seem to be saying it's not in the record because there, in fact, is no connection. I guess we don't know one way or the other, isn't that right?
The record reflects no such connection, Your Honor. I just want to make sure that that is crystal clear because I think opposing counsel is trying to confuse that issue.
So just to clarify, you're saying that the record doesn't say one way or the other, or that the record definitively says
there is nothing.
There is no connection.
There is nothing in the record upon which to draw such a connection.
Thank you. Okay, yep. Sorry to belabor that.
Perfectly fine. The driver's license issue, frankly, is also an interesting issue, but a red herring here for a couple of reasons. One, as this court has already noted, there are two addresses on this driver's license. One of them is an office suite, and the other is apparently a residential address. So the record, the driver's license, number one, is confusing about what it is. But second and most important, there is no process under Arizona law that we were able to find that confirms or verifies whether what someone puts on their driver's license is accurate or is somehow vetted. He could have put any address he wanted to on his driver's license. It doesn't matter.
Well, I think the point for him is that at the hearing, he said, you're residing at Dennis Pacifico's house? Right. That's where you would be served? That's correct. That's the address on your driver's license? That's correct. And so I think his argument is, in his mind, he's thinking the Beardsley address, which is on my driver's license, that's where I live, and that there was a leap to consider, a wrong leap that's not, you know, sustainable as a factual finding, to consider that that Beardsley address was not Pacifico's house, I guess. In his mind, yes, it's Pacifico's house, and that's where I'm living, and that's what my driver's license says.
That could very well be the case, Your Honor. I try my best not to get into the mind of my opposing counsel, but what
I'm talking not about your opposing counsel. I'm talking the mind of Mr.
Mr. John at the time. I understand. Yes. But here's the real issue with that, Your Honor. The district court plainly found a couple of things that are, I think, really important for this court to consider. One, appellant attempted to evade service. That is pretty clear, and the judge found that. Two, appellant failed in his obligation to keep respondent apprised of his current address. I heard what he said about what Appendix A says, and certainly the referee who issued an order, which is Exhibit 18 to document number 15 in the record, disagrees with him that this was an issue under Minnesota Statute 5, I think it was, he referenced 518. That is, he's confusing a statutory obligation with a decree obligation. And the decree obligation, as specifically pointed out in the September 28 order from the special magistrate, says, look, you had this obligation. You have failed in this obligation. And as a consequence, you've made a mess of this situation. And so they're holding him accountable for that. The judge, the district court judge, is holding him accountable for that.
Appellant's argument on that is, this is independent litigation now, just to renew a judgment. So it's a whole separate proceeding from the family law proceeding. So how do you respond to that?
Well, it does arise from the family law case, Your Honor, and it is connected because I believe this underlying judgment was for failure to pay child support, as you can see from the contempt order from 2016, which lays out everything that happened, and I believe that 2012 judgment did arise from child support arrearage. As a practical matter, while I don't disagree with you on a fundamental level, Your Honor, that this is a separate action and that's clear under the law, there is also a clear connection between the renewal of a judgment and the existing judgment and what that judgment was for and which case it arose out of. So I would disagree with you to the extent that there is no connection between any of those things. And all of the proceedings...
I'm not saying this. It was appellant. So you're not disagreeing with me necessarily because we have this, you know, we haven't ruled on this yet.
I understand. But as a practical matter, the parties and the referee all had this in the underlying case. All of the testimony, the record that was established from Mr. Jun's testimony came from that family law case. So this is all interconnected. So I think that's important for this court to recognize. And I do want to also point out, twice in that hearing, Mr. Jun had an opportunity to give his exact address. He refused. And twice, once he volunteered, I live at Dennis Pacifico's house, and then when he was asked by the referee, he said, I live in Dennis Pacifico's house. I think the logical conclusion any human being would come to on that is he lives with Dennis Pacifico. In fact, in his presentation, I don't know if it was a slip of the tongue, but I heard opposing counsel say he lives with Dennis Pacifico. So, and I think the more fundamental issue, Your Honor, Your Honors here, is the district court didn't believe him. They didn't find him credible. The only evidence in the record from only one person who said he didn't live at the Longhorn address is Mr. Jun. Mr. Pacifico, who put an affidavit in the record and who could have clearly put this out there, did not do so. I think this is more gamesmanship by Mr. Jun, and this is longstanding gamesmanship that we've been dealing with for a considerable period of time. This is one more example of that.
Excuse me. Could you speak to the evading service? I think I heard you say that the district court made a finding about evading service. I'm looking at the district court's order, which deals with substitute service, and it says, plus there was actual notice. Can you point me to the findings and then maybe address the law and what the argument is about that? I assume you're making an alternative argument that even if there was not service at the abode, there was, help me with that. Why, where is that finding and how does that help you?
I believe, Your Honor, that finding can be extrapolated from paragraph 12 of the findings. There may be some other ones, but that's the first one that comes to my mind. And it talked about difficulties that we encountered as part of that. And I apologize, Your Honor, what was the rest of your question?
Well, yeah, I'm just looking at the conclusions of law, and I see it more around substitute service at the abode. But where does that take you? What's the law? Is this an alternative argument, even if there was not service at the abode? Somehow there was service because there was an evasion of service, apropos of, I think, Chief Judge Siegel's question. Like, where does this law take
us? I don't think, and I don't take it as an alternative argument. I think it is part of the overall findings that the district court made here, that this was unnecessarily complicated by appellant's actions. And I wouldn't say that we have service on him because of that, because he was trying to evade service, but I think it's fundamentally clear, Your Honor, that the rules of civil procedure regarding service don't contemplate a person with this kind of means and a person with this kind of intent to try to avoid service. It made things extremely difficult for us. And frankly, Your Honor, we believed we had him properly served on August 10, 2022. We didn't believe we needed to have a private investigator hired until the motion to dismiss was filed. We assumed everything was good to go.
Okay, so the sole issue before us is, did the district court clearly err by concluding that he was served at his usual place of abode?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, it's still the
same. He was served via substitute service.
That is our position, Your Honor.
Thanks.
This is not an issue before this court, but we also argued to the district court that to the extent there was any issue about Beardsley, we served him there too via the efforts that we made and consistent with existing law. That's not an issue before this court today, but we made both arguments below. And that issue is not being appealed or is not here on appeal. But as a practical matter, the substitute service here, based on all of the surrounding facts and circumstances, the letters, the checks that we got for well over a year, his own testimony, and connecting
and
all of those dots.
Just ask about the checks. When you reference the checks, what's relevant about the checks is not an address on the checks. It's just that they were within an envelope that had the Longhorn address.
So the checks both have a Longhorn address on them, and the envelopes both also have a Longhorn address on them.
Whose checking account is it?
It appears to me that the checks came from Mr. Pacifico's checking account.
So Mr. Gent wasn't signing the checks?
No, but his name is identified in the memo line on all those checks. And as a practical matter, Your Honor, this is, again, not inconsistent with conduct that we have experienced in this case. Mr. Gent, as the 2016 order clearly establishes, has been moving, has made very creative ways of moving money around. And one of the things he does is gets other people to pay bills so that we don't know where his bank accounts are.
So Longhorn address is on the check. It's on the return address of the envelope.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Counsel, Mr. Gainsley seemed to suggest that we don't even know what the judgment's for. Does that make sense?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because I think you can look at the record in the underlying case, and particularly that 2016 order, and I think that does lay out what these are for. I will tell you this, Your Honor. All of the judgments that we received from him are not due to a contract, are not due to any intentional tort. They are all connected to his failure to live up to his obligations under the divorce decree.
In the divorce decree, was he ordered to pay child support?
Yes.
Obviously, maintenance?
Yes.
Yes.
Property settlement, all of those.
Okay.
And he didn't do any of them. And so we had to go,
but Mr. Gaines,
I heard what he said, and I disagree with him. And I think there is evidence in the record that will show what those judgments were for. I mean, they certainly weren't given out freely without a lot of effort and without a lot of evidence presented to the court. Unless you have any other questions for me,
The district court judge found that Mr. Junt, is that the right way to pronounce it?
Yes.
Yeah. Had more than one usual place of abode. So is there, was that an error? Is that an issue? Can somebody have two usual places?
Yes. I believe that is completely consistent with the law. I think we all know people that have multiple different homes and places where they live at certain times of the year. I think depending on how you slice and dice it, you could be in more than one abode at the same time if you are going back and forth. I think that's still consistent with existing law. You know, abode means a place that you intend to stay, but it doesn't mean permanently. I think the language in the case law says for a considerable period of time, but as far as I can tell, that's never been defined by any case law. And I have, frankly, several clients that have homes in many different places and travel to them all the time. So I think it's very consistent, particularly with the day and age we live in, and particularly, frankly, in the post-COVID era where people have many places they go, that I think this is something under the law that definitely is supported by the existing case law, that you could have more than one abode.
In places like Florida and Arizona, they call them snowbirds.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yes, I think absolutely a person can have more than one abode. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
The short answer to your question, Chief Judge Siegel, is that anything that happened after August 22 is irrelevant. The court made a finding that he was served on August 22. Whatever happened, and there was some, whatever went on in Beardsley, where he was not involved, he wasn't even in town, but the process service returned an affidavit, excuse me, a proof of, quote, non-service. So that's dispositive of that. If we're going to start believing process service, and the process service files an affidavit saying non-service, that ends it. But we don't get there. We don't have to get there. The service, the judge said, was made on August 22. They say August 10. Anything that happens after August 22 is irrelevant to this appeal. This appeal is, was he served on August 22, 2022? And the answer is, he was not. But I need to emphasize, counsel has said it in the memorandum, said it again this morning, he never, ever refused to give his address. You will find nowhere in the record where he refuses to give an address. He wasn't asked, he didn't tell. He wasn't asked what his address was. The closest that they came was, so you live with Dennis Pacifico? Yes. But he was never asked an address, and he never refused to. You'll never find anywhere in the record, I refuse to give my address. He did not.
Just following your argument, is there any evidence in the record that Dennis Pacifico did not live at the Longhorn address?
No, there's not that I know of, no.
Okay, all right, thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
I think I heard counsel answer a question of one of your honors that this judgment came from child support. If that's the case, we don't belong here. If that's the case, this judgment could have been renewed administratively and not by litigation. Child support, that's a specific statute that talks about the renewal of a judgment of child support. It's by administrative and not by, it's in the judgment statute, and not by litigation. And that's a very significant difference. If now they are taking the position that this judgment came from child support judgments are renewed administratively, not by litigation. This is litigation. This was an action, a summons, complaint, answer, motions. That's litigation. That's not child support. And by the way, I should also correct the record. Mr. Junt was never tardy on child support. Maintenance may have been a different issue, not child support, not on custody, not on parenting time, never failed to appear at a hearing. Let's not paint such a bad picture here, But if we do paint the picture of child support, then we don't belong here. This should have been done administratively.
But you seem to say you're not sure what it was for.
Yeah, the record isn't clear.
It was a property settlement.
That would be a different issue. Yes, I agree. We don't know. And the fact that we don't know, I mean, it seems to me the burden was not on us. By the way, the record is sealed. I couldn't even get to it. But if we don't, it seems to me the plaintiff in this action should have said so. This judgment was based on X, Y, Z.
What do you mean the record was sealed?
Yeah. I'm sorry, Your Honor. This record was sealed. I don't know how, and I don't know who, and I don't know why. I have tried and tried and tried to get my own client's records, and they won't give them to me at the Hennepin County District Court Administrator. It just is. I don't know why.
What, was it reduced to microfilm or something?
No, I go to macro, and it's empty. It's empty. Go to macro, and you will find, I think, my motion or my name, period. Anything before me was sealed. It's wrong. I mean, this whole case, for lack of a legal expression, stinks. He doesn't belong in this position. He didn't create this position. She is suing him. She had the obligation to find him and serve him, period. I also disagree, and the law disagrees, that Appendix A isn't a part of the decree. Appendix A is a part of the decree. The statute makes it a part of the decree. And Appendix A specifically says child support, maintenance, and parenting issues. This is none of those. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory